The following podcast is brought to you by the Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome. I just wanted to begin by offering my deepest condolences to Kjelgen and his family and all that are here today for the memorial service. I'm not sure how everyone else is doing, but these past few months have been nothing less than completely overwhelming. And I feel like we're all kind of living in this collective trauma together these days. And I try to remind myself and like to remind everyone how important self-care is in this time. I wanted to begin by saying that Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter a great deal for me. For those of you that don't know me, I'm a jazz musician. I'm a jazz piano player. And Black Lives have made my life what it is. Basically, without Black Lives, I wouldn't have a career. Without Black Lives, I wouldn't have the form of expression that I have. And just as we think about offering gratitude and appreciation for all the past teachers, going all the way back to Shakyamuni, I feel the same way going all the way back to Louis Armstrong. And just the same way that we make a Keshemiyaku chart with Shakyamuni that leads all the way down to our name, the same thing could be done starting with Louis Armstrong and going through all the generations that lead to now. So I just wanted to start off saying that. And I wanted to kind of look at what is happening now reflected through my story. So I'm going to tell a little bit about my story, the story of this body, of this one body right here. But I invite you to kind of imagine that I'm not only talking about just my body, but maybe a collective body of people that make up a country such as ours. So when I was very small, when I was very little, I had a traumatic event that happened to me in my life. And I was very young. So at the time, I wasn't able to make sense out of what happened. And there wasn't any kind of processing that was happening around me as well. So I didn't really have anything to do with the information that was being presented from what happened to me. And so what I ended up doing, as I think many of us do, is I ended up repressing all the feelings that, all the different, very complicated and very difficult feelings that came up from this event. And so I ended up finding a way to repress it, and I built my own mechanism in a way to keep myself safe. As time went on, and I went into my adolescence, I think that I was aware that there was something that was not resting well inside of me. But at that point, there was a lot of anger and a great deal of denial that there was something wrong with me. And I would say that this denial and repression continued to kind of swirl around in me for quite some time until eventually there was an explosion. There was a breaking point. It had reached a tipping point that it couldn't continue like this anymore. And when that happened, you know, it was very difficult at first, but it was a very important thing that needed to happen for me. And it was something that made me very humble, and it was something that made me, for the first time, feel like I need to turn and face these things that I've been denying or turning away from for so long. So without this breaking point, without this explosion, there was not going to be anything in me that was going to be able to look at what was going on, look at the parts of me that I felt were broken and that needed attention and that needed healing. So I began on that path, and this path led me eventually to a Zen practice. Now, you know, like so many people, I entered the Zen practice with the idea that I wanted to fix this part of me that was broken, and since that, from that explosion, was this idea that I needed to fix and change, and maybe possibly even just completely get rid of, cut off this part, these parts of me. So as I was writing this talk, I had a memory of the Shuso Hosen ceremony for Ryoshin. This was, I can't remember what year, this was probably 2005 or 2006, I'm thinking. And at this point I became very gung-ho in Zen, and I was really excited for this ceremony and for the opportunity to maybe engage in Dharma combat, which I had not done before. So I had done some reading the night before, maybe we have all done this, on the koan that he was going to speak about, and I was thinking about what my question was going to be. And without getting into what the koan was, in Ryoshin's talk, I remember specifically he was speaking about, he spoke a lot about his father, and his father had some kind of a crippling condition. I can't remember if it was polio or something along those lines. And he made this kind of this gesture when he would talk about his father and in his illness, something along these lines or like this. And I remember when it came time for me to ask my question, my question was something along the lines of where I felt like I was imprisoned or I felt like I was trapped and I didn't know. And I asked him, what was the way out? And his answer was that. And that was like an arrow shooting through my heart, because that was, I don't know if it was the first time, but I had been hearing more and more about this. And that was the first time maybe that I felt, oh, wow, all this broken stuff, all this stuff that I think is wrong with me, it's okay. This is the message that I was getting. It's okay. Not only is it okay, but it's the key for what I'm looking for the freedom that I'm looking for, the liberation that I'm looking for. And then years and years later, I ended up receiving this Rakusu, and on the back of it, Roshi wrote, "You are the sound. You are the sound of the Dharma. And again, hit me like a ton of bricks. Really? That little boy who was just so confused and didn't know right from left, up from down, that was the sound of the Dharma? That adolescent that was screaming and angry, that was also the sound of the Dharma. All of these things that I hated about myself, now I was realizing were the keys to my liberation. So I wanted to speak a little bit about this koan that I think speaks to this and also maybe to everything that's happening right now. And this is case 94 from the the Book of Serenity. This is called Dang Shang is Unwell. And the koan goes like this. When Dang Shang was unwell, a monk asked, "You are ill, teacher, but is there anyone who does not get ill?" Dang Shang responded, "There is." And the monk asked, "Does the one who is not ill look after you?" Dang Shang said, "Actually, I have the opportunity to look after him." The monk asked, "How is it when you look after him?" And Dang Shang said, "Then I don't see that he has any illness." So it's kind of a tricky koan. At first, it seems like it doesn't make sense, right? Does the one who is not sick look after you? Actually, it's the other way around. So, obviously, physically in this koan, Dang Shang is sick, but I think that this monk is asking something else, and he's trying to get to a different, something broader. And I think that we can maybe shed some light on this. We just change some of the words around. And instead of using the words ill or illness, we can try and see how this would go if we use the word broken. "You are broken, teacher, but is there anyone who is not broken?" "There is." "Does the one who is not broken look after you?" "Actually, I have the opportunity to look after him." James Baldwin said, "Love takes off the masks that we fear we cannot live without and know that we cannot live within." I use the word love here not merely in the personal sense, but as a state of being, in the tough and universal sense of quest, daring, and growth. Love takes off the masks that we fear we cannot live without and know that we cannot live within. So, when I think about this koan and I think about the story of my life, of course, is the broken place that guides me. It's the place that I shunned, the place that I pushed away, the place that I pushed down deep inside and was ashamed of. That is what guides me. It's the broken place that guides us, that heals us as a person, and maybe also as a nation. Billie Holiday, great jazz singer, well, although she didn't write this, this is one of the songs that she sang, had these lyrics. You don't know what love is. You don't know what love is until you've learned the meaning of the blues. Until you've had a love you've had to lose, you don't know what love is. Until you've faced each dawn with sleepless eyes, how could you know what love is? I think that saying, I have the opportunity to look after him, is the same thing as saying, you are the sound of the Dharma. It's the same thing as saying that love takes off the mask that we fear we cannot live without and know that we cannot live within. And I feel that I feel very strongly about this right now. I'm actually very hopeful with the situations that are happening right now because of what I've been talking about. I saw this explosion as a necessary action that was bound to happen. And my hope is that from this explosion, we can move to a place of healing, to a place of actually reflecting what is really there, because that is what Zen offered me. First, Zen offered me a way to look at myself, a mirror to see who I was. And, you know, I think there's many areas of that mirror that were purposefully left dirty or blurred. And, you know, the more that we practice, oh, wait a second, that side is not really clean. And you clean that off and say, oh, shit, oh, that's right, that happened to me. And we have to relive these things over and over in order to get through them. You know, James Baldwin also said, not everything that is faced can change, but nothing can be changed until it's faced. And that is what Zen offered me in my life. And I'm hoping that that is what Black Lives Matter and this current movement is offering to our country. There's the broken place that guides us, that heals us. And I'm not sure if there's a better example of this than that of the jazz musician. Historically speaking, if any of you saw the movie about Quincy Jones, it's funny the stereotypes that I think that a lot of people have in their minds when they think about jazz musicians. But for Quincy Jones, and for Black musicians at that time, actually becoming a jazz musician was a way out, was a way to. A way to have a dignified life. And it was also a vehicle for them to explore and reveal true expression. In the jazz scene, the way that musicians kind of view each other and maybe judge each other also has much less to do with technical proficiency as it does with honest expression. I remember one of my teachers once was talking about this in a certain way, and he was like, look at Billie Holiday. I'll bring her up again. He's like, what kind of a voice is that? Right? And if we really think about Billie Holiday, maybe we could even consider a Bob Dylan, like someone like that too, right? Someone who's just like, you call that singing? I'm like, what the hell is that? And at first, like, it doesn't seem to register. But for the people who knew, just like when Buddha twirled the flower in his fingers, for the people that knew, they're like, that is a true expression. This is something special. And the music was an avenue to also explore this idea of taking care of the one who is not ill. Because true expression and Buddha nature and the sound of the Dharma includes everything. It doesn't omit anything. So if there's anything that you're leaving out, it's going to feel that way. It's going to feel like something is missing. And I think that the master jazz musicians had a way of understanding this through the sound that was emanated through other musicians. So if there was something missing, you're not being honest. You know, you're a black person too, and I know that life has not been this easy for you. Just like the blues would illustrate. But I feel like the jazz musician had the courage to take off this mask that James Baldwin was talking about. Oftentimes it was very difficult, if we could think about the way society was, which I think led to a lot of the drug abuse that was happening. But when the horns went in their mouth, or when the fingers went on the keys, or picked up the drumsticks, whatever, then that was their time to let their authentic self shine in the midst of this incredibly oppressive situation. So for me, the jazz musician has been, and the idea of the jazz musician coming up through the turn of the 20th century up through the 50s and 60s, they were just incredible heroes to me, incredible people who faced the difficulties, didn't stuff them away, didn't shun them, invited them, actually. And through this music, I think we hear the Dharma of the whole Dharma of our country from the beginning of its beginnings in slavery to where we are now. And I encourage us all to maybe, if you haven't, check out a little jazz. We might think we have an idea of what jazz is, but that's like kind of saying you know what classical music is, and then all of a sudden I could play you some Shostakovich, and you could be like, what? That's classical music? Doesn't sound like Bach. So it's the same thing with classical music. There's these hundreds of years of development. It's the only thing is that in jazz, all that development happened in a really short period of time. And it's really quite amazing what happened between the years 1930 and 1970, for instance. How much was able to happen in such a short period of time with these men and women who are just absolute heroes in no small sense of the word. So just want to leave you with a couple things to ponder, a couple things that I heard of recently. I forget this man's first name, but his second name is Noel Rawls. and he was a political scientist, and he would, in some of his workshops, he would present a question to people. He would ask them what, for them to design what they would think a perfect society would be. But there was a little caveat. The only thing is that within this society they are creating, they don't have any control as to how they are going to participate in it. So they don't have any say as to what their sex is going to be, what their race is going to be, what, you know, anything about themselves, what their economic standing is. They have no idea where they would be placed in the world. And think about that along with this. I was reminded of what the rules of the sea are. Something for us to think about, us land dwellers. The rules of the sea has to do with the ones with the burden of power against those, or not against those, but in connection with those, with the privilege of vulnerability. So the laws of the sea are that power boats, boats that have big electric engines, they have the burden of responsibility because of how quickly and how much they can control their movements. They have the burden of responsibility over the sailboats, who have the privilege of being protected because of their vulnerability to the power boats and the weather. Remember that movie with Kevin Costner about where everybody lives at sea? I kind of think that the sea rules have it a little bit better than the land rules have it right now. But I love that idea that the privileged are the vulnerable and the burdened are the powerful. Thank you very much. Good evening.